We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. This summer, the Americans with Disabilities Act turned 20. At a ceremony marking the occasion, this was just a couple of weeks ago, the Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, said this. He said, "The Americans with Disabilities Act is a landmark piece of civil rights legislation. It protects individuals with disabilities from discrimination and promotes their full inclusion into education and other aspects of our society." And there's certainly no doubt that the ADA has benefited people in America with disabilities. At the same time, surveys of people who are disabled say that they continue to feel that they face serious obstacles when it comes to getting medical care, in employment, in education, and in public accommodation. This morning, we'll be trying to talk a little bit about the ADA and what it's meant for disabled Americans and where we still have to go. And our guest for the program is Mark Weber. He's professor of law at DePaul University. Disability rights is a major academic and professional interest of his. He frequently speaks on disability law issues at national and international programs. He's presented testimony on the implementation of the ADA to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. He's active in community service and legislative initiatives on disability matters, and he's authored a number of books that deal with disability law. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And questions are welcome. We ask people, please keep your questions on the topic, be brief, and that will help us to move along and get in as many callers as possible. But certainly input from listeners is welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And then if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that too. The address is will-talk@illinois.edu. And Professor Weber, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
We
certainly appreciate it. I am sure that the Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act, has changed this country in many ways, maybe in ways mostly that you would have to be a disabled person or work in this area to appreciate, and that you could remember what it was like before the ADA. Are there some things that just sort of off the top of your head would occur to you, would be dramatic things that you could say about positive results that came from having this law?
Oh, yeah. I think there are some things that, well, I guess from the most obvious things that you notice that just weren't there a few years ago, like curb cuts or accessible pathways through stores or other things of that type. But the gradual integration of a lot of people who have visible or kind of noticeable impairments into employment and into just daily life, it's something that's subtle, but it really has taken place over the last 20 years. And I've certainly noticed it. But I think that if anybody just thinks back over the last even 10 years, you see those kinds of changes. And that really is a major social change. And it's even something that is present in the U.S., I think, to a much greater degree than what you'd see in Europe, for example.
Mm-hmm. It is striking, I think, though, that the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act did indeed inspire other countries to work to pass similar kinds of laws. And I think that there are, in fact, many other countries where there is something like this.
That's absolutely right. It's been a little more recent a development in other places. There's now a United Nations Convention as well that should, I think, stimulate a lot of legislation and other efforts in other places as well.
Mm-hmm. And that's something, though, that I think is something that needs to be mentioned, that, in fact, this convention, the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, was adopted by the United Nations in 2006, and it was not until last year that the U.S. signed it.
That's true, although I think the fact that President Obama did sign it is a a very important development in the U.S., and I think it'll be a big stimulus for its passage elsewhere in the world.
Yeah, it's certainly very striking if you look at what life is like for disabled people elsewhere, particularly in developing countries, mm-hmm. that they face tremendous challenges. And one statistic I came across that it was just I thought was just very, very striking. The United Nations estimates, for example, that in the developing world, 90% of the children who have disabilities don't go to school.
Hmm. Yeah, that statistic was one I had not seen, but it doesn't entirely surprise me. The one thing that I think is emphasized by some activists, and I think has some validity to it, though, is that if you've got a society that's rapidly developing, there are tremendous opportunities to build in accessibility, mm-hmm. to develop programs, to change things in a quick way that might be a little more difficult in other places that are more built up or that have more entrenched institutions.
Yeah. Well, you also have to wonder with the ADA, obviously, that it imposed certain requirements on the infrastructure, and so we have curb cuts, and there has to be accessibility for public buildings, and there were a number of things that were required to happen, but you wonder whether if there has been a change in attitudes, in public attitudes about disability, how much of it had to do with the fact that now disabled people are more visible because they can be and can be out there and they can be doing things that temporarily abled people do, you know, working, going to school and so forth. And that has also been one of the results of the act, that it may be changing the attitudes of people, the general attitudes of people about disability.
I think that's absolutely right. And certainly the presence of people who are noticeably disabled and who just are not treated any differently from anyone else, who are taking a perfectly integrated and completely properly developed, I guess, or something would be, is really something that is striking and that has happened, I think, quite recently, you know, that people were shut in to a much greater degree previously, and it's a real development that's subtle, but that's something that's happened.
And having said that, though, I was really struck by some survey results that I came across. This is apparently was the result of a survey that was conducted by the Kessler Foundation. Mm-hmm. And this is a foundation that's interested in promoting and working for rights for people who are disabled. And they asked people with disabilities, well, you know, what are some of your experiences? And it seemed very clear that significant numbers of people with disabilities, they were having real problem getting medical care. Mm-hmm. That is 59% of people without disabilities are working age Americans. Only 21% of disabled working age Americans had a job in the past year. They're still have deficits when it comes to graduating from high school. They say that they still have real serious problems with transportation. Mm-hmm. So that there's still definitely some issues here.
Oh, yeah. I mean, actually, the poverty rate among people with disabilities is about three times that of the general population for adults. So it's not as though problems have entirely disappeared. It's also true the economy has not been entirely favorably disposed during much of the time that the ADA has been around, and so the statistics on employment are not as encouraging as I think a lot of us would like them to be. The numbers of people in employment has not gone up as much as we'd hoped.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what the debate was like at the time, now 20 years ago, when Congress was talking about the ADA?
Well, there's a quite well-known history of this by Joseph Shapiro, who is a reporter, who wrote a book called No Pity that talked about the disability rights movement and the passage of the ADA. And half of the history really is the history of the social movement. So you had people like Ed Roberts and others who were, many of them, survivors of polio, who were at Berkeley and other universities in the 1960s and started demanding accessible services, started to try to get an education, but with that needed to have curb cuts, needed to have buildings that were accessible, needed to have services that they could get at. that then led to a lot of other kind of organizing and some protest and movement in the streets. There were sit-ins after President Nixon vetoed the Rehabilitation Act in 1972. There was a somewhat celebrated sit-in at the office of Joseph Califano, essentially over delays in implementation of the Rehabilitation Act in the 1970s. There were a lot of demonstrations over public transportation. Ultimately, the legislation that came out in 1990 is part of a longer chain. There had been that Rehabilitation Act, which finally passed in 1973. There was a Fair Housing Act that had really very important effects that was passed in 1988. And the ADA had been around as a proposal since at least the late 1980s. There are antecedents going back to the 70s, but it had been around as a concrete proposal in Congress. It in the period before it actually got passed, it wasn't so much that there was a big fight in Congress over it, but there was some real concern that President Bush might veto it. And so there were elaborate negotiations, mostly between Evan Kemp, who is a guy who actually used a wheelchair, who was with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and the White House, primarily the White House Counsel, to try to get a proposal that would get through Congress and also get signed by the president.
Now, I have an email here has come in from somebody, and I'm interested in your reaction. And I'm sure that there is probably a good deal of anecdotal advice that there might be people who could tell stories about things that were done as a to comply with the ADA that would seem on the face of it not to make a whole lot of sense. So here's the story. The person writes, I work for the post office. He says, years ago, we got a new building. Shortly after it was built, we had to retrofit the bathrooms and other things to make it handicap accessible. And he goes on to write, there's never been a handicapped person in this building in the 20 years since the updates. In fact, a handicapped person couldn't even get into the building. And it seems that the person is saying, well, what is the point of doing these things if that, in fact, doesn't really benefit anybody?
Yeah, and, it's easy to kind of make fun of that and say, well, the whole reason that it's never been used is that you can't get there. But the part of the problem is that with any kind of solution that tries to impose regulation, there are always going to be some difficulties with trying to make it work, and there are probably going to be some instances where more effort is put in that that isn't productive than might be desired. But part of the difficulty here is that the regulations mostly apply to actual construction and building of things. It's less effective in terms of getting people into places than it is at trying to affect the places themselves. Mm-hmm. So you can have some situations where, because of geography or because of delays in what a municipality does, it's just hard to get to a building. A common complaint I hear from people who use wheelchairs or other mobility devices is simply repair of the sidewalk. It's too much of a hazard to simply go out and try to navigate the streets, and that keeps them at home to a greater degree than they would like to be.
Yeah.
But, it is true that some regulation is not going to work successfully.
And this, I can only take the person who was listening and who tells the story at face value. It would just seem to me a little bit surprising that, and I don't know what the particular issues are, that a building, a major public building like a post office, mm-hmm. would be inaccessible to a person who is disabled.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, although it could be a problem with geography or a problem with the repair or something like that. Actually, you do hear from a particular wheelchair user some complaints about post offices and difficulty with being able to use them, although in a lot of other places, the government has gone out of its way to make sure that things are accessible. So I would not be critical in general of the of the efforts they've done.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Mark Weber. He's professor of law at the DePaul University College of Law. One of his main professional interests is disability rights, and he's written a lot on the subject. And we're talking this morning about the Americans with Disabilities Act. And just a couple of weeks ago, people marked the 20th anniversary of the signing of the ADA. And we're talking a little bit about what it is, how it came to be, and something about what it's meant for people who are disabled, and where we still have to go to really provide accessibility. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you may also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. At the time that it was passed, apparently, a lot of people who are opponents, at least, said that the costs associated with the act, and with particularly with making businesses and public buildings accessible, they said, well, this is just going to destroy the economy. Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, the costs of compliance, it seems, have been much less than it had been expected. Mm-hmm. Some businesses might even say that what they did to make their businesses accessible to people who were disabled actually benefited some of their customers who weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And can you talk, is there some way to talk about what the costs of the act have been?
Yeah, well, it's a little hard to tell because you don't know for certain what would have been spent or not spent otherwise. But the point that there's a side effect that's quite beneficial is absolutely right. I mean, I think people who simply are wheeling children in strollers have a huge benefit from the fact that buildings in general have fewer barriers to them than used to be. That does actually increase business, you know. It's not only the business of people in wheelchairs, it's also the business of anybody who doesn't want to have to contend with artificial obstacles to getting in one place or another. But I think that that's also true in some areas that are maybe a little bit more subtle than that. If you have an employer that winds up adopting somewhat more flexible hours for workers as an accommodation for somebody who has trouble getting to the job because of inaccessible transportation, usually they figure out pretty quickly that they can generalize that benefit for other workers and that it means that they can hang on to employees that they'd like to, or that they can otherwise make their workforce happier than it would be. So there are side benefits that don't easily get translated into figuring out the costs or benefits of something, but that in this case I think are quite positive.
We have a caller. Let's talk with them. This is someone who is listening this morning in Chicago. Line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. I'm not in a wheelchair, but I am blind. I wanted to make comments on something, and then I wanted to get your reaction. I noticed that when I watch TV, or listen to TV, I guess you could call it watching, CD players and DVD players are not user-friendly toward people with visual problems. Neither is the on-demand system. I have talked to the cable company. I'm not going to mention the name, so don't worry. But I have talked to them about this, and I said, look, you have recognition software. When you call your company and they'll say, press 1 for this, couldn't you do it for your cable service? And I said, well, we'll think about it. Mm-hmm. But they have never responded. I just wanted to know, get your opinion. What do you think?
I can give you some general thoughts on that. Obviously, I don't want to start giving out legal advice.
But, no, I don't either. But
sure, I understand. The law that, as it's written, does not actually require the stocking or even the creation of specific products, which is really a weakness in the law as it's drafted. So if there were something that were more designed to actually promote accessibility of particular goods, that would be a real benefit, but it isn't part of the law right now. And that, I think, relates to the problem with CD players and DVD players, although they've probably become a little more accessible in part because there is demand for it, in part because some of the same features that make them more accessible are also things that make them more usable by people who don't speak English. So.
Well, you know, there was a time when computers were off-limits, but now we have speech recognition software.
Right.
And I think down the road, you know, this is like the journey of 1,000 miles. We'll get there. It'll just take a little longer, I suppose.
That's a real valid point. One of the deficiencies, I think, as well in the parts of the law dealing with public accommodation is that they aren't, they don't clearly, at least, cover things that are totally online. Courts have generally said that if you've got an online adjunct to a physical store, then it's covered. But if you've got an entirely online or internet service, you know, it was written in 1990. It really wasn't very well set up to cover those kinds of things. So that would be another area where reform could really be beneficial.
That is true, because right now I think we're restricted to VCRs, which is sort of an obsolete technology at this time.
Good point, yeah.
And it would be nice if we could move over, but I think we'll get there sooner or later.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well,
thank you.
Let's go to someone in, this is someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Hello, well, line one in Champaign. Well, okay, maybe not. Let me ask you this, then. I have another email question here, and there, the person listening has two questions. One, I think, is maybe a little easier to deal with than the other. The first question is about the Americans with Disabilities Act. The listener wants to know, does it apply only to projects that receive federal funding?
Yeah, it applies to private activity as well, okay. As well as state and local government.
So we're talking about government buildings must comply, public schools must comply, and so forth. But anything that's open to the public, you have a business, you have a restaurant, you have a movie theater.
That's right. The smallest kinds of enterprises are not covered by it. There's also the Fair Housing Act, which covers all but the smallest kind of housing options.
Okay. And the other question was about newly installed pedestrian signals. The person's wondering, is audio information for crossing required, and what about tactile feedback for people who have both visual and hearing disabilities?
Whether it's required, I'm not going to actually hazard an opinion on. I can tell you that there have been some cities that have implemented it quite successfully, and I've certainly observed it in a number of places. But I don't want to give a more specific opinion.
Yeah, okay. I know just fairly recently, it seems, here in the place where we live, the newer crossing signals do have cues for people who have visual problems, but not, I think, for people who would have both.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some technologies that are out there. I guess I'm not aware of a tactile-related technology, but it certainly strikes me as within the realm of what could be done.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we'll go to now. I think we have our caller ready, line number one in Champaign. Hello.
I apologize. I thought I was on line three.
Okay. No, go ahead. That's fine.
Great topic. I think as someone who worked in social services for 15 years and now is employed in schools, this is just a huge topic, and it unfortunately runs up against one of the things that I love about living in the Midwest, and I am a Midwesterner, is the pragmatic nature of American thought, that we are a very pragmatic people here in the Midwest. You know, you don't dress up because you never know when you're going to have to get out and change your tire and that kind of stuff. But what I'm thinking about is the email where somebody talked about a retrofit that was never used. And yes, that is a problem, but come on, it was a post office. They probably retrofitted it because it was just a regulation without considering the outside or exterior of the building. And what I would say for people to remember, and this is very pragmatic, is the hidden nature of disability. When we talk about disability, it means someone who's not able to perform at a level of functioning comparable to an individual who is, say, middle-aged and of very good physical health. And that these disabilities are often hidden. And if we just look at things like curb cuts, ramps, accessibilities in restaurants, there is a huge, and I mean absolutely huge, number of people, approximately 20% of our population, who benefit from this. Elderly individuals often have limited mobility. Steps are often a huge problem for them. So restaurants alone, the gentling of the landscape of restaurants, has made life easier for a huge segment of our population. And that's not even counting the other kinds of hidden disability that are accommodated every day by systems, but people just, they don't realize it, because a disability may not be visible to you. It may not involve a cane or a crutch or a walker or one of those rascal mobility things or whatever they're called. So I just wanted to point that out, that part of the ADA are these very visible things, but people forget there's a reason why when the ADA passed, Illinois at one point, I believe, interpreted it that doors to public buildings should have a 5-pound pull. And that is because someone with arthritis or someone with weakness may have a very hard time opening that door otherwise. And again, these things have benefited a huge segment of the population, which we will all join someday. So that's my comment. I applaud you for the show. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, thanks for the comment.
If I could just pick up on
yeah.
one part of that.
Uh-huh.
The thing that strikes me, I think the comment's well taken, but it's there do remain very serious problems, I think, with stigma and with failure to accommodate for people with mental impairments. And part of the problem there, I think, is that it's not, again, a visible form of accommodation, but to the degree that you can require reasonable accommodation by employers to give some flexibility, that, again, enables people to be integrated to a much greater degree than would otherwise be the case. And it's a problem that is continuing, because I think a lot of the discrimination based on attitudes with regard to either mental disability, developmental disability, or with regard to mental illness, it's just very difficult to root out.
Mm-hmm. We are just a tiny bit past the midpoint here, and I would like to introduce again the guest for this hour, Mark Weber. He's professor of law at DePaul University College of Law. One of his main interests is disability rights. He's done a lot of writing in this area and also speaks frequently on the issues of disability law at both national and international programs. He's presented testimony on the implementation of the ADA to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. He's very active in community service and legislative initiatives on disability matters. And we're talking about the Americans with Disability Act. People around the country just a couple of weeks ago marked the 20th anniversary of the signing of the act. And we're talking a little bit about what it is and the intention and what it has accomplished. And questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455 and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I think probably that one of the most contentious or controversial aspects of this continues to be, and I'm sure that it has been this way, continues to be what constitutes a disability. And according to the Act, it defines disability as, quote, a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits a major life activity. Is it clear what exactly that means? How do we figure out what that means?
Well, it's not clear, and it has been a problem. The Act has had that language that actually was borrowed from parts of the Rehabilitation Act and its implementing regulations. And it was thought in 1990 that, well, since we've had this language since 1973, and there hasn't really been a serious problem with trying to define disability under that, then let's go ahead and simply use it. The problem was that once the law started being applied to private entities and enforced to a more vigorous degree, then the response was made, well, the person who's trying to enforce it here is not him or herself a person with a disability, and so doesn't have any ability to sue in court or otherwise enforce the law. And that rapidly became extremely elaborate, with people arguing whether one or another condition was or was not a disability. Ultimately, the Supreme Court had a number of decisions that read that term of the law quite narrowly. That was in 1999. There was a lot of effort to try to change that legislatively, but it didn't actually happen until 2008. And so there's now the Americans with Disabilities Amendments Act, or the ADA. So that is designed to overturn what the Supreme Court had done and to make the definition itself broader to encompass more people. Mm-hmm. Exactly how that's going to play out, we don't know for sure. It's the act was made so it wasn't effective until January of 2009. So things working their way through the courts, for example, basically haven't shown up yet. So we're still waiting to see what judicial interpretations there will be. But it is true that there is a big definitional problem, I guess, and that's maybe a problem with trying to put anything into law. I'm hoping, in general, that as social attitudes change, that you might need to rely a little less on legislation, but you never know. So it's good to have the legislation there.
Well, it does certainly seem to be, and we can talk about this more in detail, but it certainly seems to be that if someone is bringing a complaint under the Act, that the burden of proof seems to really be on the plaintiff, mm-hmm, here. That is that, you know, for example, that if a person is saying that they have a disability and that their employer, say, is not providing the adjustments, the accommodations, that it's up to that person to say, no, yes, I really do have this disability, and this is what it is, and this is the problem that it's causing me. And apparently that's really very difficult, and many of these complaints, most of the complaints, and in fact, as I understand it, most of the complaints that brought to the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission actually end up being rejected.
Yeah, although that's not unusual for civil rights laws in general. You tend not to have as high a success rate as you do, for example, with auto accident cases or something, you know. The law was actually what Congress thought they would do to try to solve problems of that type was to have a definition that not only embraced people who had the disability, but also people who were regarded as having the disability or having a record of the disability. And so it was thought that, well, if somebody is somebody whose heart impairment, for example, doesn't really restrict their activities much, but nevertheless winds up getting denied a job because of the heart impairment, well, that person is regarded as having the disability. The courts, however, didn't read it in quite that way. They required that you have to show that in the mind of the employer, whatever physical condition there was something that was a substantial limit on a major life activity. And for an employee trying to show what was in the mind of the employer at that time, it became near to impossible. So what the 2008 law does is modify that significantly to make the regarded as part of the law much more easily usable. Part of the difficulty was kind of you were either not disabled or you were too disabled. If you wound up showing that you got into the definition of somebody with a disability, that was taken to mean that you were unable to do anything, and then the employer would come back and say, aha, but that means you can't do the job. Mm-hmm. And so the claimant would lose under one prong or the other. And the law now is written in such a way that I think it'll be a little more widely applied.
Yeah. Well, it was really, and I'm not quite sure I completely understand this, but that it was the big change here was that before, say, 1999, around that time, the court ruled, the Supreme Court said, well, if you have some kind of impairment and your employer can address that by making some accommodations, then you're not disabled. And that the big change was that in the law it said, what we're going to do here is first we're going to consider the impairment first, and then we're going to then the issue of accommodation is something different.
Yeah, it's actually a little different from that. The idea that came out in these Supreme Court cases in 1999 was that if the person in some way mitigated the impairment, so either by taking medication or even conceivably by something like a prosthesis or something of that type, then you would evaluate the impairment in that mitigated state. Uh-huh. That in and of itself is not crazy. It's a perfect perfectly possible interpretation. The difficulty is that that was then coupled with this very restrictive view of what regarded as was, so that it was extremely difficult to get qualified under the law. And what the 2008 law does is that it alters both the mitigation term or mitigation idea, and also changes the idea with respect to what the regarded as definition means. So what Congress was really trying to do this in this most recent change was to try to change the focus from whether the person is in the mind of somebody or other or someone with a disability, and more on whether there actually has been what we would call disability discrimination, whether somebody acted on the basis of somebody's physical condition or mental condition. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there is a question then of whether that acting on was justified. Obviously, if somebody has a mental impairment and cannot do some things and the employer needs those things to be done, then it's not unlawful discrimination to reject that individual. On the other hand, if the person is being rejected where a reasonable accommodation could enable the person to do the job or where no accommodation is needed simply because of an attitude or something like that, then that's where the discrimination would take place.
Hmm. So I find myself kind of going back, though, to this, the way the Act defines disability, and then the question being, well, that's pretty broad, physical, mental impairment substantially limiting a life, major life activity. Someone has to decide, well, what is it? It does it, you know, what is it, and does it substantially limit major life activity, and what life activity, you know, all that. So what is the mechanism for deciding whether something is a disability and qualifies under the Act?
Well, that's what you've got courts for. You know, if a case is handled through the EEOC process, then it would be determined there. But typically, the cases wind up being in the courts, and it becomes an issue that the judge or the jury would decide in a case, just as they would anything else. The act, though, that passed in 2008 actually did say that it was Congress's desire that the emphasis be placed on whether there was discrimination rather than on whether the person had a disability. So how much effect that will have, it's always hard to tell. But courts may get a signal from what Congress did.
We are coming into about our last 10-12 minutes here in this part of Focus, and our guest is Mark Weber. He is a professor of law at DePaul University, disability rights, a special area of his, and we're talking about the Americans with Disabilities Act. It was signed 20 years ago this summer, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. At the time that it was being debated, people predicted that there would be this enormous economic burden, which turned out not really to be true. People also predicted that there would be an explosion of disability rights-related lawsuits, and it seemed that really didn't happen either. Was that simply because how much of that was that it's actually a difficult process to manage, and it wouldn't necessarily be an easy thing to successfully pursue a lawsuit?
I think that may account for part of it. The lawsuits are part of life, you know, and certainly it's not made a huge bump in the horizon of the lawsuit world. You do need courts, you know. They're required to enforce anything of this type. What's happened to some degree is that there has been voluntary activity that, and it's a very good thing, that's in some instances supplanted or prevented the need for lawsuits. So, for example, a major part of what the ADA was trying to accomplish with regard to public services was, for example, to have them be in a less restrictive kind of a setting, with the idea that, for example, people who have very severe either developmental disabilities or mental illness who are currently, say, in nursing home settings or in large state-operated facilities would be able to be served in a less restrictive kind of a setting, such as a group home or a community option. And there has been litigation on that, but some states have actually been very aggressive in acting on their own to promote community alternatives and services. So in some instances, you've had politicians and administrators who've been very responsible, have seen the purpose just of trying to have more freedom for people, seeing this as a good thing, and so haven't had to be prodded by lawsuits.
Mm-hmm.
There are some glitches that are occurring now because with problems of budgets at state levels or at state and local government levels, some of the community options benefits money has started to dry up. So that could make things worse again. But there has been a lot of very positive voluntary activity on the part of government, and not really on the part of a number of private entities and employers as well.
Mm. Well, that's interesting. That seems to be another one of these areas that some people would argue we really have work to do here. That is, in with respect to the fact that there are millions of people, some of them young people with disabilities, who live in nursing homes, mm-hmm. and that they are people who might be able to live with their family or in a more independent kind of way if the kind of support was available for them in their community. In a lot of places, it's just not there.
That's a real valid point. And, you know, in need surveys done of people with disabilities, typically housing and institutionalization-type issues are either at the very top or very, very near the top. Because, I mean, there is the fear, I think, of a lot of people, even who are not currently in an institutional setting, that if they don't have the support services they need, that's where they'll wind up. And they don't want that. They want to be out and active and in a community setting or with a family. And that can be difficult to achieve without supports.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the way the law is currently written, it's permissible for a state to get federal money to fund much of that, provided that it's no more expensive than the person being in a nursing home, which is a little bit convoluted. You know, it was really written more as a cost-saving measure than as a measure to promote the independence of people with disabilities. So more funding in that area would be extremely helpful.
All right, let's take some other callers here. We'll talk with someone in Charleston, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This is maybe a rather simple or basic question. You may have already touched on it. I used to teach at a community college, and we have an area that, of course, you know, there's parking for people who have disabilities. But it seems like an excessive amount of parking because, you know, maybe half the time their spaces are full, and I've really never noticed them being full entirely. Is there something that sets the amount of spaces that have to be provided for people with disabilities?
The answer is yes. There are formulas that are written into the regulations. And part of the problem, of course, is that, as we were discussing earlier, the people who have seriously disabling conditions, you know, including mobility limits, don't have a lot of money. Obviously, some people do, but the fact that people generally are at a lower economic level means that they tend to have fewer cars. So that it could be that part of what we're seeing is the both ends of that equation being played out.
I didn't quite understand. It just seems like there's an excessive amount of spaces allowed for that, and if they didn't have a car, they wouldn't be parked there anyway.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying. The spaces tend not to be filled in many instances, and that's more an indication of the fact that people aren't working and able to get
a car. Okay, now, but why are as many spaces allowed as there are? Because once again, it seems excessive to me.
Yeah, it was designed to try to have an adequate number. You know, and certainly there are some places that have probably more than the law actually requires, and I don't know about this particular situation. There are actually quite a number of places that don't have any, even though the law's been on the books for quite a long time.
Sorry to hear for the ones that don't have any. But in any case, I usually find a parking spot, so there's no problem. But it just seems like there was more spaces than I could.
Uh-huh.
You know,
yeah.
Obviously, you can't see all the disabilities. You're right. Because, I mean, sometimes it's obvious, and other times it's something that isn't, but just a question. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Let's go on here to, we have somebody else. This is someone in Effingham, line four. Hello.
Yes, I'll go to the positive side. I'm a retired light delivery employee for something like UPS, but we drove just four wheels, and I was inherited a hearing problem from my ancestors, and it became obvious in the 1960s. And at that time, the Interstate Commerce Commission had a law that you had to have 80% of hearing in the better ear, or you were out. Well, the company I worked for found another spot for me, non-driving, and I worked at that for 8 years. And then the law changed, mm-hmm. and it stated that you could be employed as a trucker with or without a hearing aid. Before, it was without a hearing aid. They didn't recognize that. Then the law changed. Then you could drive commercially with 80% of the hearing in 1 year, which I qualified for with the hearing aid. Mm-hmm. And so then I got my old driving back again, and I went on with my life. But that was an instance of a company who understood there were problems, and then they responded to it. And I was it would have changed my life had I not had the job. But luckily, things worked out, and the law changed. And I think it included a lot of people who drive. I see truckers with hearing aids to this day. So I just want to relate that as a positive note. And disabilities, like the other gentleman said, are not always obvious, but nevertheless, they're there. Thank you.
All right.
And I'm sure your employer got a good driver out of it, too, you know, so it's a benefit on both sides.
Again, we have now maybe about 5 minutes left. Questions are welcome. We'll try to get some in. If we have some more callers, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Something that I came across that I thought was kind of interesting is that among the kind of disorders that qualify as disabilities under the Act are psychiatric disorders, and that apparently the number of discrimination complaints filed with the EEOC related to with people who have psychiatric disorders have in recent years dramatically gone up. They nearly doubled between 2005 and 2009. And I don't know if there's anything that you can say about that. I just thought that was really striking.
Yeah, well, there's speculation. There isn't much in the way of good social science research data on this. But the speculation is that particularly in that time era, what you've got are a lot of people being fired. People are more likely to sue over losing a job than they are over not getting a job in the first place. Mm-hmm. And there's quite good social science data on that. Think for a moment about if you've got at least a fair amount of residual prejudice, who winds up getting hired even though they've got a serious disability? Well, somebody who doesn't show that they've got a serious disability. And so those people who then might get discharged on the basis of their disability might be those whose disability didn't come out at the time they were being interviewed for the job. That could well be people, say, with mental illness that's episodic. Another area that the EEOC statistics show a large number of complainants in is people with back impairments. A person with a back impairment doesn't necessarily look disabled and so is perhaps a little more likely to actually get in the employer's door, actually get the job. And then when the disability becomes apparent later on, it becomes a discharge problem.
Mm-hmm. We're coming down to the point here. We maybe have about 2 minutes. As a way of summing up, I'm interested in anything that you might say about, you know, we've talked about positive change related to the ADA, and I'm sure there are a lot of people would say, yes, there has been positive change. At the same time, there are people, I'm sure, who would say, well, you know, we have some way to go here, and we've touched on a couple of things. Are there some other things in it that you would say should be important goals for trying to address it, continuing to address the issue?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, one of which is the housing and the deinstitutionalization and mm-hmm. keeping people in less restrictive settings. I mean, that's a huge issue and one that probably will grow as people age, the population ages generally. The second thing I think really is employment. It would be very helpful to have more in the way of job programs, job incentives. Most of the rest of the developed world, you know, Europe, Japan, Britain, either has pretty well-developed job subsidy programs to promote employment, particularly for people with quite severe disabilities, or, in fact, in continental Europe and Japan, there's actual job set-asides. And, you know, there are potential problems with setting aside, you know, 2% of your employees as people with severe disabilities. I mean, it might create some stigma or some kind of segregation-type effects. On the other hand, it does mean you have more people employed, and you do wind up exposing those people who are not disabled, including the bosses, to the fact that people even with quite severe and very apparent disabilities can make quite a positive contribution to the enterprise. So I think that programs of that type that would promote employment would be a real benefit and something that the U.S. should investigate to a much greater degree.
Just real quick, something I also thought that was very interesting is that for a long time there was a very significant gap in voting between people who were disabled and people who weren't. And I know that a number of years back, I think the Federal Election Commission found that there were literally thousands and thousands of places around the country, polling places, that were not accessible.
Right.
And apparently now that gap has closed. So in the 2008 presidential election, that in equal numbers of disabled and non-disabled people say that they voted. So that seems that that's something that has been addressed. And
it did require, actually, congressional legislation.
There
was a voting rights provision that was enacted. Yeah, and things definitely are better. I'm not sure that it's entirely been eliminated as a problem, but it certainly is much, much better than it was even 5 or 10 years ago.
Well, there we will have to stop as we're hit at the end of the hour. We want to thank our guest, Mark Weber. He's professor of law at the DePaul University College of Law, an expert in the area of disability rights. Professor Weber, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, David.